The Writer's Toolkit is published by Nick Hearn Books. Order direct from the publisher and get 20% off this and other great titles. Visit nickhearnbooks.co.uk. This is the Writer's Toolkit podcast.
Welcome to another episode of the Writer's Toolkit podcast. In this week's episode, we talk about dramaturgy and its role and benefits in the playwriting process. Engaging a dramaturg at various stages of a play's development can be incredibly useful, offering insights and guidance to support the script and the playwright, all the way from initial conception to opening night. Whether you're refining the structure, deepening character arcs, or ensuring historical accuracy, a dramaturg's objective feedback and creative counsel can illuminate the path forward, making the development journey both enlightening and effective. Before we dive in, if you listened to the first episode in this new season, you'll recall I was joined by the First Ladies of Fringe, Zena and Michelle from the Camden Fringe, who also host their own podcast, aptly titled the Camden Fringe Pod, where I joined them on the other side of the mic as a guest. They've got lots of really interesting guests there, and it's packed with wonderfully useful information, especially for anyone interested in taking a show to the Camden Fringe Festival, but more generally for anybody interested in self-producing. So do check that out too.
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast with Paul Kalbergi.
All right, let's dive in. My guest this week is Alison Horsley, a distinguished dramaturg, author and educator specialising in new play and musical development. Alison's notable projects include working on the original Broadway production of Jersey Boys, as well as various Chekhov translations adapted for American theatre and film. Alison has taught BA and MFA programs at Swarthmore College, Indiana University, and the University of Denver, where she earned tenure. Currently based down in Dunedin, New Zealand, Alison serves as a script advisor for Playmarket New Zealand, where she continues her dramaturgy and script consultancy work.
Coming up.
Some people think of dramaturgs as being like really academic, and I enjoy throwing out things in the room that could potentially be very wrong, because that also can like help people figure out what they think is right.
Alison also co-hosts Play Notes, a podcast with fellow dramaturg Emily Duncan, which I definitely recommend having a listen to. And together with Jacqueline Goldfinger, Alison co-wrote the book Writing Adaptations and Translations for Stage, a practical guide that makes the complex task of adaptation both accessible and inspiring for both novice and experienced playwrights. And I'm thrilled to have her with me today. Alison, welcome to the podcast.
Yay, cheers. It's good to see you.
The Writer's Toolkit Podcast.
Could you give us a quick Dramaturgy 101? What is dramaturgy?
So dramaturgy is a little different. It's a little differently defined by everybody. But I define it as the study of plays and their structure. And in terms of the way that I work with a playwright, I try to get a sense of what it is that they're trying to do and the world they're trying to create, and sometimes why they're trying to create it, and work within that. So I'm an objective feedback giver who helps to inhabit the world and helps to populate the world, but not take control of the world or make prescriptive choices about the world. So I'm like an in-house, collaborative, objective cheerleader who also can be kind of a critical dick sometimes when necessary, but in a nice way, a nice critical dick.
Yeah, in the most constructive way possible. That's really useful.
Yes. Yeah, in the most constructive way possible. And so so I tend to be, I tend to not be too harsh with playwrights when I work with them, because I know I myself do a bit of writing outside of this, and I know how terrifying it is to share like your beautiful baby with somebody who then potentially could come in and say, your baby is not as great as you may think your baby is. So you have to establish a sense of trust with somebody. And so I think a good dramaturg is somebody who I think has to have a decent bedside manner as well. They have to be somebody who you want to be around. And, you know, so it's not just an entirely professional, cold, you know, kind of sterile relationship. It has to be interpersonal as well.
Yeah.
So I think the best dramaturgs are the people who you can spend time with and talk to on many levels, because I feel like that enhances all of the work. And it's also reciprocal. Like, I feel like I learn every time I work with a playwright. You know, I learn about dramaturgy and how to do my practice better too. I don't know. It's at least in the States, when I was learning more about dramaturgy, there was this perception that either it was super academic or that like dramaturgs were people who had like tried to be directors or playwrights and failed or something like that. And I don't really relate to any of those things. I relate to little bits of it because yeah, you have to have read a bunch of plays to be a good dramaturg.
Right.
And you know, you should have been in a rehearsal room to be a good dramaturg, but I'm somebody who's minded like a dramaturg. It's how I approach my life. It's how I live in the world.
Right.
I'm just like that. So that's the long version.
No, that's wonderful. That's wonderful.
That's the 201 version.
Maybe we can say what a dramaturg is not. So you're not a director, you're not a script doctor.
No.
But you afford playwrights the opportunity to take a step back and to view their play perhaps through a different lens or from a different angle.
Yeah.
Maybe to view their play from the outside looking in.
Yeah, I help to reflect back, or at least reflect it according to what I see. And of course, every dramaturg, every reader is going to come at it from a different perspective. But yeah, I'll read a play and I'll reflect back to the playwright what it is that I'm seeing, and places where I think it's not holding together as well as it could, or places where I think there's an opportunity for more expansion. And sometimes I don't know what it is, but it's an instinctual thing that I can feel that something needs to happen, or we need more of something, or I can feel that there's more possibility according to what the playwright has written and what else is possible within their play. And often I'll address that and say, hey, it feels like there could be something more here. You know, what is that? So instead of being like, here's what it needs to be, you know, often it's just seeing it and then pointing to the possibility of something and encouraging the playwright to pursue that angle.
Okay. So primarily in a structure, from a structural point of view, or other elements too?
Oh, structural, dialogic, anything. Considerations about staging, anything. And I guess this is where I differ a little bit from some other dramaturgs as well. Like, I'm also used to being in a rehearsal room and watching previews of a show and watching it and then giving the director notes. So dramaturgy in the US often goes from working with a playwright on the new script to then working in the room and helping the physical life of the play as well, or supporting the storytelling and making sure that the physical storytelling that the audience is going to see supports the storytelling that's on the page as well. And some directors aren't crazy about that. They feel like that's their job, to look after the physical world of the play on stage. But to me, it's all part of the story. So I help and support the storytelling all the way through. And I think for me, that also includes supporting actors in their roles as well, and being very careful to respect the role of the director in helming the sort of psychological direction of the production, but supporting the actors and the director as they explore what that looks like.
Brilliant. So there are many different ways to kind of engage a dramaturg, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like from a distance, be it kind of script feedback or in the room in a playful kind of way.
Yeah, because in theory, it's someone who always remains objective and doesn't have like an artistic ego stake in the game, which is difficult because it means that for a dramaturg, it means that you love the project and you want to be engaged, but you're always trying to like make sure that you maintain a little bit of a critical distance.
Yeah.
So it's always a bit challenging. So sometimes I'll duck out of processes. Like if it feels like I'm becoming a little too involved, sometimes I'll kind of step back.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you get so in the weeds with it, you know, not to talk negatively about weeds or whatever, but like you get, if you're in it too much, then you can't see the bigger view. You can't see the forest for the trees. So somebody has to be able to step out and see the forest. And ideally, if you have a dramaturg, that could be them. And, you know, in New Zealand, that version of dramaturgy doesn't tend to exist as much. Like often the dramaturg will be like in there with everybody and they kind of stay there. But the version that I was trained in was what one of my professors, the amazing Catherine Sheehy, calls Teflon dramaturgy, where you're sort of like there and then you unstick.
Right.
So you're not welded to the production. So dramaturgs can support playwrights' work in so many different ways, like not only as a cheerleader inside the process, but as a kind of evangelist outside of the project as well. So a lot of the work that I've done is in lobby displays or audience engagement,
okay.
program notes, pre-show discussions for donors of a theater, giving them the inside scoop of what they're going to see and giving them some inside tracks of what to look for in the play to help enhance their experience. And that helps to build more educated audience members who will then hopefully grow an appetite to see more new work. And that helps the whole system proceed.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can engage those skills to support in a lot of different aspects of production.
Gosh, that's so exciting. It's so multifaceted.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, and some people are better at other parts than others. Like I'm, you know, I love doing program notes and like interactive type audience engagement things because it is a way to engage your critical or creative brain, you know, in part of the process and have a little bit of your artistic vision in there, but it's totally in support of the play.
Definitely. So as it relates to a dramaturg in the room, in an R&D/workshop setting, but in a kind of broad sense, are you able to share any example exercises of kind of a playful way that you might explore a play in a rehearsal room, perhaps with actors and the writer and possibly a director?
Sure. And I'm not somebody who, I love table work. Like I'm not somebody who tends to be up on my feet and like working with the actors. Like I figure that's more of the director's bag. But I love table work where you read through the script, actors can ask questions, you know, make comments, make observations. And I will often be involved in that process, raising additional questions or observations from that perspective, not necessarily of an actor, but from that more macro view.
Yeah.
Especially if the playwright is not in the room, or if the playwright is in the room, the dramaturg can be a kind of mediating factor. So the playwright isn't necessarily having to talk directly with the actors, you know, and get into any nitty gritty, because often a playwright, you know, you want to be able to stay back a little bit so that the other artists can bring their work to it, because the interpretation part is so much a part of that. So I like being a bridge between what the playwright has done and then what the production is going to be, helping people to see what I see in the play. And I realize I'm speaking about this very abstractly, but like, you know, just observations like, oh yeah, and this character says something very similar, you know, later on, but they've changed their mind, you know, and not saying, and therefore it needs to be acted like that, but just making observations that maybe even, you know, if the director hasn't voiced it or an actor hasn't observed it or voiced it, it's just a separate, yeah, objective voice in the room who's like a, you know, who's the still waters a little bit in the midst of everything else, who can go, oh yeah, I see that such and such is happening, or what I'm hearing is such and such. So it's not unlike therapy or a therapist in some sort of group environment where you do a bit of work to say, you know, here's what I'm seeing. Oh, what do you see? Oh, that's interesting that you're seeing that.
Yeah, yeah.
Huh, could it also be such and such to try and,
right.
to try and build a sense of community around the play and a shared vision too.
So posing questions is actually in many ways far more important than giving any answers, right?
Oh, 1,000%. It's funny that like I was saying earlier, some people think of dramaturgs as being like really academic. And I sort of enjoy throwing out things, you know, in the room that could potentially be very wrong, because that also can like help people figure out what they think is right, you know, and if it, you know, and to say like, okay, well, in another world, such and such could be happening. And when people go, oh my God, there's no way that would happen. Oh, because these people think blah, 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 blah. It's like, yeah, that's right. They do. You know, so it's,
yeah.
I think it's, I don't know if that's the opposite of Socratic, but it's something, it's some sort of method.
No, it is.
But
it's really useful.
Yeah. And so I feel like a dramaturg's role is to be comfortable being that person.
Yeah.
Because your role is to question and ask and ask the really uncomfortable questions often. I mean, I was we did a reading for a new project that I'm working on a couple weeks ago, and there was a situation where there's a character who the playwright was struggling to fully integrate into the script. And then there was discussion about, well, can the theater afford that other actor and this and that? You know, like there's all these conversations. And I was like, okay, well, there's this other character who we said was a little bit weak in terms of how integrated they are into the storytelling. If that actor is already contracted, well, are they already contracted? Because what if we cut that character instead of that other character? Dramaturgically, this other character who's not fully integrated needs to be more integrated than this other one that we're questioning could be cut entirely. And then that allows for this other person. And I felt like in a situation like that, because I'm not a full-time staffer, I'm not a whatever, I'm a freelance kind of rogue agent, I'm in a position to potentially ask that question because I don't have a horse in the game.
Yes.
I'm not involved with the casting. I'm not writing the play. I'm not an actor. I'm not a director. But yeah, I mean, that I was like, I'm going to be the asshole in the room. I'm going to ask, is that actor contracted? Because their part doesn't seem that important. So what are we going to do? You know, like fight for that part. Fight for that actor. Do they need to be there? Then make it necessary.
Justify it.
Yeah, justify it. Yeah, yeah. So often a dramaturg is the person who's there to ask the question that maybe other people who are more psychologically tied to aspects of the production can't necessarily ask.
Yeah.
Oh, and in terms of other creative dramaturgy, working with Des McAnuff, who like directed Jersey Boys, and he's just directed the Who's Tommy on Broadway. He does big musicals. For a long time, he would have the dramaturg like lead essentially a kind of graduate school boot camp for the actors in the first week of rehearsal during table work about the historic and cultural context of the play. So for Jersey Boys, for example, these people had to hear so much about like New Jersey, Italian immigration to New Jersey, the history of contemporary music in the US, like, you know, what doo-wop is, the structure of the mafia, all these things. And part of it is to have the actors go around the room and read different parts of the research.
Right.
So everyone has to hear the research all together. And then what they used to do, or at least I don't know if it's still the case, but they'll do a thing called Name That Scene, where after the scene, like we'll, you know, read the scene aloud and then we'll discuss whatever relevant kind of research has applied to that scene. Then the cast has to vote on what the funniest name of that scene will be. And that's how the scene will be referred to in like blocking and stuff like that.
Oh, I love that.
So it's a unifying thing. And again, as a dramaturg, often it's about the esprit de corps as well. Because again, it's getting everybody in the same world for the to be on the same page for storytelling.
It's so important.
So So it's weird. It's weird psychologically in that way.
I think the actors also really appreciate that background that you can share with them. It brings them on board at a different level than just reading a script, because it's beyond the window of the script that you see the world of the play. Mm. If you pull back slightly and see the bigger picture with my verbatim play, The Countess, the very first morning of rehearsals, we took the entire cast to the cafe was the center of the play, brought along some original contributors who gave testimonies for them to meet the people they were playing on stage, see the world of the play physically, to get a sense of place.
Yes. Oh my God.
Not every play you can do that, depends on, you know, what the play is, but we were able to give them that kind of rich attachment to the heart of the play, which was really valuable.
Oh my God. Well, yeah. And with a play like that, because it's so rooted, obviously it's rooted in reality. It's a verbatim play, but to be able to see the cafe makes all the difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
In American dramaturgy, that's a much more normal thing to do for a dramaturg to do. Like in New Zealand, that doesn't seem to happen as much here, but I'm working on a local production of Constellations with an American director, but Constellations, you know, the British play. Mm. And we did a little field trip out to look at a beekeeper's beehives, you know, so the guy playing the beekeeper role can get a sense of what that is and ask questions about, you know, okay, hey, why did you go into beekeeping? What are the weird parts about it? What's the joyful part? Just so that actor can get inside it a little bit more.
Yeah. Something tangible.
Yeah. And that's what first drew me to dramaturgy, was doing the research and like the nerdy detective work of going back into a script and like figuring out what the influences had been. So I love doing the retrospective kind of engineering of the play by doing the research. I love that.
I'm all about that.
Oh my God.
I'm all about that. I love talking about immersive writing in my workshops and how we can physically enter the world of the play where possible.
Oh, yeah.
When we did In the Tall Grass, actually, we rehearsed key scenes around the city of Dallas. Where they happened at the time of day that they happened, so the cast could see the hue, the color of the sky at that time of day.
Yes.
And I think all of those layers of the fabric and texture of a place that you can bring to the stage is invaluable. But if you can't get to the actual setting, you know, what can you find around you that speaks to the world of your play? So if you're writing, for instance, I don't know, a World War II play, can you go to the War Museum and sit beside a Spitfire plane? And what can you absorb from that? And who might come and sit next to you that might have a story that they can share with you? Any physical entry points to the world of your play, I think, are invaluable.
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, even just in my life, I enjoy asking people, like strangers, who I only have a single encounter with, like a taxi driver or something like that, you know. I love asking them about their weirdest stories because it's a way of getting inside other people's lives, and you hear the craziest shit.
Yeah.
That people will share with you. And as a writer, you can pack that away. You know, of course, I'm doing it as a person and a dramaturg and I guess a little bit as a writer, but it's those things that if you're continually just picking up on what people's experiences have been of the world, that can continue to feed your craft. Yeah.
Definitely.
But yeah, like the smell, asking somebody, what was the nastiest, like for example, for the World War II thing, you know, saying, what was the nastiest thing you had to eat when you were serving, you know, in the Pacific? Because I have a friend whose dad was in hospital here in Auckland, and he ate so much mutton and lamb that he could not eat any more mutton or lamb for the rest of his life. Because he ate so much of it. And that was a man who went back, you know, and lived for the rest of his life for, you know, whatever, 60 years with this hatred of those things. And that's it's a weird little character thing, but it's a wonderful one.
Yeah.
You know, and you wouldn't know it had you not talked to that guy.
Yeah.
And it's a war story.
But it's part of the character.
Yeah, it's part of the character. You know, that it's not just that the characters aren't just the events that they're experiencing.
That's right.
They're a matrix and a kind of constellation of all these other things.
That's
happening
right.
at the same time.
And unless we're telling a cradle to grave story, you know, the characters exist beyond the window of the time that we're seeing in the play. So what, you know, just pull back.
Oh my God. Oh yeah. Well, and that's, and I mean, and for writing dialogue, especially, you know, it's so situationally oriented, you know, like I used to tell my students what you as a person will say, if your best friend asks you how you're doing and how your day's going, what you say to your best friend versus what you say to me as your professor. About when I say, hey, how's your day going? You might tell your best friend, oh my God, I got a fight with my, you know, my boyfriend. He's being such a whatever. And then this happened. And then, and then there was this, you know, and then my foot hurt. And then I have this cut on my hand, you know. Whereas exact same situation, same reality, you tell your professor, I'm doing okay. It's been a little tough, but I'm all right. Because you're not going to, you know, you're not going to tell your professor about your fight with your boyfriend or your cut on your hand. I mean, maybe you will, but like, hopefully not. You know, hopefully you filter according to the person you're talking to.
Definitely.
And that's something that I find often for younger writers, they kind of forget that we all do that no matter what our age is and no matter the situation.
Like, oh, absolutely.
The power dynamics constantly shift. And like, that's one of the things with Russian plays, like with Chekhov, there's a lot within the language that tells you what the status is between the characters that gets lost in the cultural and also just the linguistic translation of the plays. So it's important to, when writing, to pay attention to whatever culture you're writing in and figure out the little ways that you can, as a writer, that you can like transmit or indicate status.
Yeah.
Very, very easily. Because with Chekhov, it's in the names. Like, you know, if a character calls another character by their first name and their patronymic, it's a sign of respect or age or status or historic status, whatever, versus by the nickname.
Yes.
Then you know exactly what that relationship is. I don't know. I'm a Chekhov and a Russian nerd. So like I love that stuff. But it's a good lesson for playwrights writing in their native languages as well.
Definitely. It can be quite jarring when you read Chekhov for the first time and see the same character referred to four different ways.
Oh my God, it's so confusing.
You know,
it's so confusing.
I'm constantly flicking back to the first page to remind myself who was this person.
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's like you have to draw out a little map.
Yeah,
and you have to give yourself a little cheat sheet. I mean, I, God, when I first started reading those plays, I was terrified and I didn't understand them at all. And like, it's only because I learned like Russian stuff that now I'm like, oh, that's why that is. But yeah, for a non, you know, a non-Russian speaker, yeah, it's complicated and in the too hard basket, you know?
Yeah, but persevere. Like, yeah. I would implore anybody to persevere because, yeah, there's so much to be loved in Chekhov.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
The conversation continues after these messages. The Writer's Toolkit is published by Nick Hearn Books. Order direct from the publisher and get 20% off this and other great titles. Visit nickhearnbooks.co.uk. This podcast is fueled by coffee. If you'd like to support the show, you'll find the Buy Me a Coffee link in the show notes. Welcome back to the Writer's Toolkit podcast.
When is a good time for a writer to consider engaging a dramaturg?
I think it depends on a couple of things. I think it depends on the writer and what their typical process is, if they have a typical process. Like, I would say if you're a writer who is, I don't know, why don't we compare it to pregnancy? If you're a writer who's like, I think I might be pregnant, like, you know, I might be with play, I'm not sure, you know, like... It you could always talk to a dramaturg in a kind of bouncing ideas kind of way.
Right.
Not in that the dramaturg is going to give you ideas, but in a, huh, would it be interesting if I wrote a play about an uncle and his niece undergoing that experience? Or I've thought about, what if it's just about the uncle and his wife? You know, and then a dramaturg can say, you know what? I kind of am leaning into the niece one. There's something in there just based on what you're describing. So it can even begin there in terms of the relationship.
Prevention rather than cure.
Yeah. Yes, very much so. Because I can often tell, and this is where the weird, like, interpersonal therapeutic part comes in. I can often tell what a writer is more interested in writing about just based on how they describe their ideas to me.
Mm.
You know, I'll be like, well, you've made this other one sound really boring.
Right,
so
right,
I kind of
right.
think, I think there's more meat and stickiness.
Yeah.
And it's that the other one is like nastier and stickier and interesting. And that's where you want to go,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So often you can start there. It becomes a little bit of a challenge in terms of working relationship and how you establish an agreement or something about what you're doing together and how the dramaturg gets paid. Because that's the other thing that's always a bit of a challenge is like, you know, we do it for the love. Obviously, I do it for the love. But, you know, you also have to make a living.
Yeah, yeah.
So you often want to have some sort of arrangement, even going into it to be like, hey, can I buy you a coffee and bounce ideas with you? Or can you help me think through this? Or because I have a friend here in Dunedin that I do that with who's a playwright. Mm. And, you know, we'll sit and she'll be like, hey, can I buy you a martini and let's chat? And I'm like, yep, martini covers it.
Okay.
But to be fair, if it's a major playwright, you know, if Roger Hall is like, hey, I want an hour of your time to run ideas by you. And he's I work for Play Market and he's a Play Market client. So I literally do this, like it's a normal part of the job. But hypothetically, if there's a major playwright who's like, hey, can I have an hour of your time to chat ideas with you? I would say, hey, major playwright, pony up a little bit more of something because you're in the position to be able to do that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if it's, you know, but if it's a playwright who's still kind of getting their feet under them or whatever, who hasn't had like epic financial success, then I'm cool with something casual,
yeah,
and whatever. So you, I think you can start it there. Yeah.
So pre-first draft is possible in terms of an initial conversation.
Totally.
With a view to let me come back to you further down the line.
Mm-hmm.
Or
totally. Some playwrights want to feel like some playwrights don't know what they're trying to write until they've written it.
Mm.
You know, it sort of is like, you know, you start writing and you kind of like vomit it all out and then you're like, okay, I don't know what I have, but I have a thing.
Yeah.
So at that point you can bring a dramaturg in. It also depends on their level of skill and comfort. Like I'm very comfortable with looking at plays at any part in the process.
Mm. Mm.
I mean, like I said, I'm good to be like the niece idea over the wife idea,
yes.
You know?
Yeah.
But another dramaturg may not feel the same way, but I like looking at something.
Yeah.
Don't quote me on this, but I like looking at something that somebody has vomited out.
Right, right.
and seeing like, hey, here's the connective tissue I see in here that holds together. I think you're onto something. I don't know about this other part. It doesn't hang as well with these other bits. And I can give feedback like that as well. yeah, like if somebody like vomits on the page, I can be like, hey, that part's interesting and that part's not. And some playwrights feel more comfortable with somebody else seeing a play or a work once the playwright feels more confident about it. Mm. And that's understandable as well. So sometimes I won't see something until it's a real first draft. And then I give a more formal version of feedback on it, right, where it can be like written or like a video consultation or something like that. Or if it's somebody I know and it's in person, you can like meet over coffee or whatever. But but I find once a play is more of an established thing in terms of it's fixed on the page, often that requires a level of fixed feedback to match to match whatever the play is sitting at the moment. So it tends to be a little bit more formal, but you can certainly do that.
In terms of preparing to engage a dramaturg, is it useful for a playwright to be intentional with the goals and what they want to achieve through those sessions?
I think as much as they can be, yes. As a dramaturg, it's hard when a playwright is like, I don't know, I just want to know if it's good or not. You know, because it's like, of course we all want to know if our work, you know, if somebody thinks our work is good or not. But usually you at least want to have a couple questions in mind of like, hey, are there moments where you feel like, you know, the action doesn't hang together, or the character feels inconsistent, or the language feels inconsistent, or, you know, moments that just don't feel like they flow with the rest of it. So it can be vague like that. It doesn't have to be like, do you think the dialogue in this particular scene does the job of the whatever, even though that's probably a good question too. It can be really specific, but it can be vague. I think you just, you do want to set parameters though. Like if you do not want feedback, let's say you know who these characters are, you love your characters, no matter what, you're keeping the characters, even if you're changing, let's say, the plot that they're in, you know.
Yeah.
And if you know that, then tell the dramaturg and be like, I'm married to the characters. You know, what I'm not married to is this and that. Please give me feedback, all those things, but be aware that I am really attached to the characters. That's helpful just so the dramaturg, you know, knows what they're working with.
Yeah, and what to look for, right? I guess if you're doing a pass for logic versus a pass for the story or whatever, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And then you won't come at it, you know, and waste energy, you know, trying to understand why something isn't working, you know, because I spend a lot of time in the notes giving process or the feedback process trying to figure out why something pings weird to my ear. So often it's part of the training, it's part of the practice as a dramaturg or as someone who gives feedback, not only to be able to recognize the thing that doesn't feel right, but then to go to the next step of, all right, why doesn't it feel right? How can I express why it doesn't feel right? And then potentially what action could the playwright take if they want that kind of feedback?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and often I don't even go there, but the easiest way to give that type of feedback is to say like, hey, do you want that part to make sense right there?
Right.
You know, which is like the sort of, unfortunately sometimes is mistaken for good dramaturgy, because it's a question and it's like, that's kind of a backhanded question. You know, that would be like telling your friend if they come out in a horrible outfit,
sure,
you know, you're not like, would you really tell your friend, are you trying to look good?
So subtext is key.
You know, like, subtext is key. Like, obviously you're saying that you think it looks bad. So don't even ask the question, did you want that part to make sense? Or is this intentional? I mean, sometimes you can say, is this intentionally confusing? Because maybe they are trying to confuse you. But going that next step of understanding why. And for the playwright to have a sense of what they're open to feedback on, is helpful for the dramaturg to know how many of those steps they need to go through, and how and what they can say and not say, because it's always tough. Like when you're looking at somebody's work and they're inviting you in to share their work in it, you know, they're sharing it with you. It's you're always a little afraid of stepping on something that's like a sacred thing to the playwright, that then if it trips them off or if it upsets them just enough, you're worried that then they won't look at the rest of your feedback. You know,
right,
if you make them angry, if they take it personally, as opposed to taking it as like an objective evaluation of their work product.
Yeah.
But rather, if you step on something that's like, I keep thinking of the term pet corn, because it's something that shows up in Chekhov, like, you've stepped on my pet corn, which is like the weirdest phrasing, but anyway. But it's like, if you poke a soft spot for somebody, often, they'll turn on you. And so as a playwright, it's good to know where your soft soft spots are, and to be able to express that to a dramaturg, maybe even in advance if you can, or if you can't express it in advance, at least when you're looking at their feedback or having that discussion, knowing that you might be sensitive around some things and knowing that that might be impacting the way that you're taking their feedback.
Yeah.
Which is always a tough and sensitive matter, you know?
Yeah.
But I feel like that is almost more important than what the feedback is knowing the how would be most useful, and the scope of what they can address.
Okay.
Is almost more useful than like, how's my dialogue?
Yeah.
Is it good?
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
So I think parameters are useful. And also how far in the process you think you are.
Okay, yeah.
If you've been working on it for 5 years and this is your 30th draft and you give it to a dramaturg, like maybe tell them that. Because as a dramaturg, I don't want to engage with something thinking it's a first draft when actually it's your life's work. Because that will affect the way that I give you notes. And maybe that makes me soft somehow, but I also think it makes me more strategic and kind, you know, and better able to give effective notes according to the situation.
You can meet the playwright where they're at.
Yeah, you're exactly. Yeah. And so as a playwright, you need to be honest about where you're at. Like if you're like, I just crapped this out in the last 2 weeks,
yeah,
but I think it might be something, what do you think? Then I'm going to give a very different type of feedback for that than I am with somebody's mother's story, you know, where, so as a dramaturg, I might want to come to something and be like, hey, you know, this just seems quite unbelievable. I can't believe that could actually happen to somebody. And this seems like this is a very unlikable character. And then for the playwright to be like, actually, it's based entirely on my mother. And that's exactly what she was like, you know, and you just don't want to, I don't know.
Yeah.
It feels like a trap or something.
Oh, like I've tried scenes of this play out at scratch nights. It's not landing with an audience for whatever reason. So you've got that backstory.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Coming to it with the backstory, or just saying, I don't want to give you any backstory. I want your really honest feedback.
Yeah.
Sure. Go for it. But just be prepared for. Yeah.
Sitting down to kind of implement feedback, whether it's notes from a kind of online virtual session or learnings from being in the room, sometimes taking all that knowledge away can be quite overwhelming when you sit down to kind of open the document and like, right, shit, now what do I do with this?
Totally.
Any tips for kind of approaching the next draft with this new learning?
I think, as always, it depends on the writer. I would say with the new learning, maybe I could see that it would be useful to jot down your initial ideas, like right when you get the feedback. If you're like, I don't know how to incorporate it, but maybe if I did that with that, maybe I could do that with that. Maybe get it all out on a page or all out in whatever form you have your brain external hard drive, you know, like get it all somewhere. And then I would say leave it until you're able to fully process emotionally and psychologically whatever you've been through with the dramaturg, if it's like a workshop or whatever, so that you can kind of reset your internal compass and then maybe look at all of those notes and then look back at the feedback and try to take it in small objective ways. So again, try to separate your emotional subjective, you know, feelings about the work from whatever objective concrete changes that need to be made. So I think taking that space and giving yourself that grace and the distance and sometimes even a little pampering, just to be able to like, just be like, okay, and here's who I am again. Here's what I'm doing. Okay, well, here are some of my initial ideas, having gotten that feedback. Here's what seems to stick for me. These are the bigger things. I'm going to think about how to implement those. Where can I implement those? And sort of go that way.
Yeah.
So it's not like you get home that night and you change the entire play according to every single note that was given. But I would say in a process, you're generally not going to have, if you have little tiny things, you're probably not going to have giant things. If you have giant things, you're probably not going to have tiny things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I was going to say some playwrights might go tiny to bigger. I would be more prone to go bigger to smaller because the bigger is going to change the shape of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think the key to me, at least, and now I'm sort of talking as a writer,
yeah.
The key for me is to jot down all the things I've learned immediately so I don't lose it, and then to look back on it and see what makes sense and sticks.
Yeah. probably worth saying also, you know, not all feedback that you take from anybody will be right for you or for the player. You know, we're not we're not writing by committee. So it's how do you filter that information as well and decide, you know, which bits are the gems that, that speak to you and kind of make sense with your vision of the play and which bits to disregard.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. You have to filter it through you. You know, like it has to, you've got to have a bit of a net.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Really important what you said about the benefit of distance and time and affording yourself that space to kind of sit with the thoughts for a while before you sit down to try and jump in and make changes.
Yeah, yeah. And if something, if some feedback felt icky, you know, or feels really wrong or really niggly, figure out why it does before you implement it. Why is it pissing you off? You know, like if somebody has said something about a character, you know, and you're like really mad about it, but you don't even know why you're mad about it, interrogate that and figure out what that is in terms of the role of the story and what you're trying to do with the play and find out why you're mad. And usually there's a reason for it that can come out in the dramaturgy of the play. Why are you that upset about that particular thing? Like, is it because you're proud of the way that you were able to put it on the page? Is it because you feel like that is so integral to the message you're trying to deliver with the play? You know, all of that's fine, but you need to know your why. And I always, I just always find a lot of value in whatever the niggly bits are. So wherever the sticky points are, that's where your attention wants to go because it's sticky for some reason. If it's sticky good or sticky bad, you want to look there. Yeah.
Listen, Alison, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate all the insights you've shared.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's just, I don't know, it's been really cool to talk about it. I love being able to talk about the craft and like, and I love it so much. Like, I love the process. I love writers and I don't know, it's my favorite. It's my favorite part is actually the talking, bouncing bit of the feedback. It's not even reading the script and doing the written stuff. It's the like, hey, but what about that? What about that? No, that sucks. That's my favorite part.
Well, listen, anybody out there who wants to perhaps engage you and talk to you about their work, are you open to new clients right now, new playwriting clients, and how do people find you?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a website for good or for bad. It's alisonhorsley.com. But yeah, I am taking new clients. This year is a little funky because I'm working on a couple bigger projects that have taken more of my brain space. So I'm taking a break from the freelance stuff, like literally like right now. Yeah. But then I'll ramp back up as springtime in New Zealand comes around, or I guess as winter starts to fade a little bit, then I'll be back on the ball.
Wonderful. Brilliant. That's fantastic.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for the wonderful conversation.
Take care.
Next time,
I'll be joined by actor and playwright Christopher Lieberman and Sharon Willems, the artistic director of Barons Court Theatre, where Christopher self-produced his play Bunnyman back in March.
It didn't occur to me I would need anyone's help, but equally, I didn't think I'm going to self-produce. I just kept doing the jobs a producer would do, and at some point I was like, I guess I'm producing this.
Billed as a supernatural take on the trans experience, Christopher shares his journey of bringing Bunnyman to life as an early career writer, while Sharon talks about nurturing new talent and fresh writing, as well as the unique challenges of running a pub theatre.
There has to be some sort of recognition of where the stepping stones really are, where they genuinely are, and where the doors are genuinely open. You don't have to have had like 5 shows and won an Alfie to like get into the Barons Court. You know, you just have to have a good story and be willing to do some work.
Until then, keep writing, keep exploring, keep advocating for your work and ushering it to the stage. But most importantly, stay inspired.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Writer's Toolkit podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love for you to leave a review and share the link with your friends. This podcast is fueled by Ko-fi. If you'd like to support the show, you'll find the Buy Me a Coffee link in the show notes.